Call Saul, Season 6, Episode 4, Hit and Run is over, but we are just getting started talking about it here on Poster Recap. So everybody, I am Josh Wigler, and I'm joined by Antonio. Get in the car! Antonio, what are you doing over there? Come on, Antonio Massaro, get in the car right now. Let's go.
Just getting my root beer, my friend.
I will give you a whole case of root beer on the other side of this podcast. We got a podcast right now.
Got blood sugar problems. Can't podcast without my root beer.
That makes sense. We're getting to the root of the problem here on Better Call Saul today, Antonio, as we are talking about episode 4, Hit and Run, directed by the great Rae Sehorn herself, Kim Wexler. A very character-focused episode of Better Call Saul this week to talk about, Antonio, with nary a mention of the late, great Nacho Varga, which I found to be slightly upsetting. I don't know what your mileage is on that, but I was like, hey, no mention of the guy. Okay, all right, moving on, I suppose.
Not your story anymore.
Definitely a Howard Hamlin heavy episode for sure. A very big friend of the cartel, Saul Goodman episode as well. Some firsts, a first meeting between Kim and Mike. So in many ways, I think that this was somehow both a monumental episode of the show, also a quiet episode of the show. With maybe at first blush, not a ton to discuss would be, I think, was my first read on it as it was unfolding. And then on the second watch, it's like, oh, I think that there's actually a lot going on here.
There's a lot going on, especially in the context of Better Call Saul in the Breaking Bad universe, for sure, with character crossovers and events that we're seeing, or places, locations, characters' lives we're seeing in a different way that we were introduced to or saw in Breaking Bad. So there's that element of it. Of course, we should expect a refractory period, a cool down period after everything that happened with Nacho. We cannot sustain that level of intensity and major plot happenings every single week. This final season is too long. If we only had 5 or 6 episodes left, maybe, but we don't. We're in the long stretch here in the final season. So it definitely makes sense that we would stop down and really get into the nitty gritty on some of these things, including seeing the titular hit and run per se, not a hit per se, but definitely a run, and seeing that in the title and seeing more of Jimmy and Kim's plan, seeing more opportunities for them to reform it, and them just charging forward. And like I said, seeing all the Breaking Bad stuff. So a very good episode on all those levels, and I think an expected cool down.
Yes, absolutely. So we're going to break it all down, of course, today in our recap. We'll be back in a few days as well with our feedback show. If you want to get in feedback for that podcast, you can write in bcs@postshowrecaps.com. That's bcs@postshowrecaps.com. You can also talk to both of us on Twitter @RoundHoward. That's me @ACMazzaro. That's Antonio with how many Z's, how many R's?
2 Z's and 1 R this time.
Yes, just this time. You could also talk to both of us in the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord when you sign up to become a patron of Post Show Recaps by going to patreon.com/postshowrecaps and joining the Better Call Saul podcast discussion there. Start of the month, always a great time to sign up. We would certainly appreciate it. patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Antonio, of course, people could also be helping out the podcast by subscribing, leaving reviews, star ratings, all of that good stuff. Give us as many star ratings as Cliff Main would give that latte that he had.
A 5-star latte. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, he loves it. He hears they're putting Java Joe's out of business.
Yes, indeed. All right. So let's get into this one. And I do think that like the first major headline is just like right off the top. If you didn't know it watching the episode, it is worth reiterating now and stopping down and talking about a bit that this is Rae Sehorn's directorial debut on Better Call Saul. And indeed, I believe is the first star of the show to get behind the camera. I know Giancarlo Esposito will be directing an episode later this season as well. What did you think of Rae Sehorn's first at bat?
I think it was a lot of fun. I think it was purposeful in a lot of its choices. Some interesting stuff in the background of some of the scenes. Some really fun collaboration with the director of photography and some fun stuff the camera was doing throughout the episode. So I think it was an incredible first outing. I really think that the purposefulness of a lot of the choices shows through the more times you watch it. And I think that's a high mark of really good direction on the back end there. So full marks for Ray Sehorn. Very impressed. And of course, very impressed with the Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul team in general, that they're so collaborative, that for actors like Ray Sehorn who want to learn about all aspects of the process, it just sounds like this is the ultimate in film school experiences. So you listen to the Insider podcast, everything sounds so collaborative. This is not the first time that somebody has been kind of bumped up, if you will, or allowed to spread their wings. And you're talking about what's happening later this season with Giancarlo Esposito. But, you know, you hear about people making their way up from a production assistant into this, into that. And it's all part of the big family of production there at the Better Call Saul Breaking Bad universe. So I really like thinking about that. University, exactly. Yeah. Not American Samoa either. This is the real deal. So
With respect to American Samoa. Yes.
All due respect to American Samoa. I don't want to shade anybody here. Go Land Sharks. But but yeah, I think it's really cool. I just think it's really cool to think about the fact that Ray Sehorn came onto this show as maybe a lesser known cast member, wasn't the biggest name in the cast. She certainly was not an experienced director of Emmy winning television. And now in the season's the show's final season, she's in charge of the thing. She's running the show for this episode. So that's just really cool that there is that matriculation that they encourage.
Yeah, and she gave a great interview with my former colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, Dan Feinberg. If you haven't read that yet, I would seek it out. It's a really good interview with her that's very process-focused and less about the story of the episode, and she's reiterating a ton of what you're talking about here about writer's assistants who come up and become writers of full-on episodes in this show. And in a similar vein, she is somebody who had been working on like a short project and then expressed interest with a lot of the crew of Better Call Saul, and then expressed interest with Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould about wanting to direct an episode, and just kind of tossing it out there and putting herself out there in that capacity, and then getting the nod of like, yeah, we've got an episode coming up this season if you want to direct it. And her talking about how like, I'm a little terrified to do this, but this is, you know, why not do it at the masterclass, right? You know, if I've got this available, if I've got these resources available, why not take this swing? And I, like you, Antonio, I'm very impressed. I think that there's such a clear sense of personality in the direction of this episode. Very, very character rooted. Just like, I think I feel like there's a lot of perspective that I access in this episode. I feel really in Kim's head in this episode. I very much feel like I am in Jimmy McGill's head as he is wearing Howard Hamlin's head in this episode. There's just like a couple of shots in this one that I found to be really exquisite. I really loved it. We'll talk about the cold open in a moment. I'm calling them Blue and Green because I didn't catch their names. But when Blue and Green just like walk into the kitchen and you're like this whole time, you're wondering, what the hell am I watching right now? And then they just walk into a room filled with like Gus Fring mercenaries.
Right. And it was just, balletic. Like, they're like flowing around the room.
Yeah, they're stretching because they've just gone for their, you know, little ride. Yeah. They're like, do you want some iced tea? Yes, ma'am, that would be great. You know, like it just was so casual and felt almost like Tarantino-esque in that way of sort of just like sort of the ridiculousness colliding with reality and the two things existing, coexisting so seamlessly together. And then things like the camera being on the car door when Jimmy is going to move the parking cone is just a really, really nice touch. The first sighting of Kim in this episode felt so intentional to me because Ray Sehorn has talked so much about Kim's ponytail as sort of like this totemic object for Kim Wexler, and just like this this like sort of iconic symbol of how deliberate she is. And so it was just like focusing on the back of her head and the swivel of the ponytail as she's trying to just get her chair in the exact right spot so that Cliff Maine is going to be able to see the full view of quote unquote Howard Hamlin's hit and run. And just a lot of like negative space over the shoulder of like this idea of someone's always over your shoulder looking past you. And especially in that scene between Kim and Mike at the El Camino Diner towards the end of the episode. I really was very, very into it all. And of course, the big we're riding along with Gus Fring and all of his anxiety by the end of the episode. She did a great job of just grounding us in where all these people are at this moment in time. I felt very connected to the characters in this episode. And I think it's a huge testament, of course, to the writing and the performances as always. But no, like having some personal connection with the director herself based on how many hours of TV we have seen her on. I don't know. It made this one feel a little more personal to me when you know who's directing the episode.
No doubt about it. And that they love their repeat directors on this show. They love working with the same people. They have worked with some people who have gone on to much bigger and larger and more significant projects. I'm thinking about Rian Johnson and Breaking Bad, for example. But they really love the people that they can bring along and really develop or work with again and again and again. And that's great. But they also sometimes bring in people who have never directed a Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad episode. You listen to the Insider podcast sometimes when they have these people on, and it's like, well, I wasn't a fan of the show until I got the gig, and then I went back and watched, or I'd heard about it. Sometimes that happens. You're talking about with Ray Sehorn directing, not only a person who is intimately familiar and feels supported by this entire family that she's been part of for the last 6 or 7 years or however long this production's been germinating, but it's somebody who knows well, has thought about purposefully a lot of these characters, has probably talked to a lot of the actors about their choices over time, has seen that evolve. And in doing so, probably has a better perspective, like you're saying, about where the characters are at and finding them in this moment. And I think this is a really good episode for Ray Sehorn or anyone positioned similarly like her in that environment to direct, because it's an episode that is very important about setting those things out. It isn't a very action heavy episode like the last episode, for example. It isn't one where we're really just dealing with one big story that we have to kind of get across. We've got several different things in play here, several different deep mindsets of these characters, and setting those in the right spot and putting us in league with them, it really will only benefit the rest of the season.
Yeah,
because we understand better where they're at and we understand better their approach. The moments are going to hit more significantly when they do hit. When Lalo ultimately does face off with Gus Fring, however that plays out, it will be after we've already lived with Gus's nervousness about whether he should wear. Is that Chekhov's gun, by the way, Josh? And
sure,
on his ankle.
It.
On
sure
his ankle, you know, things like that. So
yeah, but it's also tying the laces together, right, of the Jimmy and Kim storyline and the Fring side of it all, when yep. Mike is coming to her and we're finding out the answer to who has been tailing Jimmy and Kim, and it's Mike, you know, and it's you know, on orders from Gus Fring, and it's the idea that maybe Lalo is out there and maybe he's going to have eyes on you, and that nervousness, that unsettled feeling now leaking its way into the Jimmy and Kim side of the storyline vis-a-vis Kim. These things are all now tying together, and whether or not this is going to be like the big final push of the season or not, it's at least leading, you know, it's speeding up the anxiety for both sides of the show in and using this same central ingredient as the thing that is unifying those feelings of unease. So I actually do think a lot was accomplished in this one while also feeling very intimate. So really impressed with this episode. I wonder if this is going to be like a little bit of a divisive one. I do think that there's a possibility of people being like, that was kind of boring. But I feel like this one warrants a second or third look from people who felt that way. I think that this is a really packed episode, a really rich one. Let's get into it. Cold open, Antonio, blue and green on their bikes. These are the best things in life.
Blue and green. Yes, this is their outfits. Their what did you think we were doing when we first encountered blue and green here?
I had no idea. I felt there's almost something like, this is not quite right, but there was almost something like Stepford Wives-ish about it, you know,
yeah,
like it felt alien in yep. some ways. Like yep. I wouldn't have been surprised if like they had bicycled into their garage and instead of going to the kitchen filled with mercenaries, they would go into the kitchen and then like take their heads off and put their real heads on, you know, like there was definitely something that felt like totally unreal about this whole scene, which certainly works because these two people seem to be nothing more than Gus Fring plants.
See, we're both weirdos, you and I.
Yes.
And you think of aliens right away. I think of David Lynch.
Yes.
And so I'm thinking the kind of a sped up or an extended version of a Blue Velvet opening, for example, seeing what the sprinklers on the lawns and the suburban lives and riding around and commenting on these houses and then juxtaposing that, of course, with where they end up, which is just being completely nonchalant about men in bulletproof vests and with guns on their hips standing in their kitchen and ignoring them as they waltz around and stretch around and don't even really engage with what's happening there. The the discordance, the comparison of those two vibes, of the suburban vibe, that there's something going on behind those closed doors that you don't know about, and that is very unusual and foreign to the environment that we're presenting you. Feels like to me when the camera goes under the ground in Blue Velvet and you go past the idyllic, maybe Stepford, maybe whatever you want to Stepford. What am I doing? Mm-hmm. Maybe Stepford.
Two Stepfords.
Yes. And Stepford was Gerald Ford's stepson. Uh-huh. And the camera pans under the ground and you see the ants or the insects just right there under the surface, speaking to what it's really like behind these doors or behind at beyond the surface level in these suburban environments. It was very reminiscent of that. Very evocative. Very good job with this opening. And there was a red house painted here, Josh.
Fire
that was very
red.
Upsetting. Fire yeah. engine red. We got HOA discussion. These people seem to be living normal lives. Is that your ultimate takeaway, that this is their life? These are not actors that are brought in. This is a house that Gus has a tunnel to and that he's paying these people for, but these people do live in this neighborhood.
My head went to their actors. My head went to that this is that this is an expression of the lengths to which Gus Fring is willing to go in what we could very much, you know, quantify as his obsession with all things Salamanca, with his, you know, his unrelenting focus on revenge against Hector and where that has brought him and all of the resources he's willing to pour into that effort, that every last bit of Hoyos and the drug trade and every single step that he takes is all about the dance around Hector Salamanca and getting ultimate revenge against this guy. And that he would go so far as to create a tunnel. This dude loves tunnels, by the way. No one loves a subterranean secret lair like Gus Fring. You know, this man.
Yeah,
is
who
just
built this tunnel? That's what I want to know. Who was the original Werner Ziegler?
Maybe he's like, I could call the Frenchmen for this one. So maybe that was like a consolation job.
I think this was a pre-existing tunnel. I think when he set up 1213 and he started living there, his first thought was, all right, I got to get my safe house set up across the street now. I got to get my escape tunnel set up.
Yes.
This does not seem new to me, right?
100%
this is the thing that he's calling it in. I mean, he is, I don't think the play, I don't think the cameras in the room, in the kitchen is all necessarily always on board. I don't think he's got 24/7 surveillance there. I do think it was kind of temporary that the couple was living in the basement. Apparently we saw a bed and a kitchenette and like a rolling rack for clothes down there. So I don't think that part is normal, but they know all about people in the neighborhood. They know about where the streets are and when the streets end. They're talking about it in the garage when no one else is around. These two people live in this house. I strongly believe it. And this is just what's happening right now is that Gus Fring's people are squatting in there watching Gus's house.
The thing that I come back to is Gus doesn't take a ton of chances. I mean, we're seeing him a little bit more wobbly these days than we've seen him in the past, but he's so meticulous. He's such a control freak that I feel like if he has a whole ass safe house that he has a tunnel connecting to from his basement to somewhere else across the street, that he's going to want to have maximum control over that other house. And I think that it's not outside of the realm of possibility for him to be literally hiring people to occupy the front-facing aspects of that, and that would be more within his control than paying off a couple who just sort of like happens to live there and can like comfortably walk alongside their hallways while there are people just squatted down with assault rifles hanging out. But I don't know. I think either way, and I mean, it's almost sort of like, you know, tomato, tomato, because either way, these people are fine with it.
Right.
They're either actors in league with the whole operation, or they're living in a home that they know is bought and paid for by the chicken man, who also is a purveyor of crystal meth and who knows what other incredible amounts of crimes that he lords over. So they're either totally in on the act as part of Gus's payroll and are like dangerous, formidable people in their own right, or they are just, you know, morally gray anyway and are down to do this. But
it works either way. You're right. Yeah. And I'm sure on the Insider podcast, they'll probably have more specificity about this. But There's something strange going on. How long has it been going on? Who these people blue and green are?
So
I
don't strange.
Know. It's so strange.
But it ends on 12/13, and it, depending on how thorough your Breaking Bad memory is, we already have some feedback on this for the feedback show. You would clock that this is Gus Brings Home that you do see in Breaking Bad as well. I didn't clock it until we got to the end of the episode, so I was still kind of mystified as to what's going on here. I'm sure the episode will bear it out. And then further behind the curtain, you and I were texting. It's like, if they don't make this clear by the end of the episode, I'm going to be so confused and annoyed with this cold open.
Right. And it'll be, yeah. I mean, as normal viewers, we'll probably be like, okay, intrigued. We're annoyed because we have to sit here and then speculate. And then next week, they'll just be like, oh, duh, that was obviously this. And oh, my God, what do we do? Yeah. But yeah, it looked like the Gus Fring. I remembered the kind of pull-up driveway. That was the only thing that stood out to me. I did not remember the house numbers. But they've started doing this, I think. Hopefully, this is a thing we're going to do. We're going to do a cold open, and we're going to know by the end of the episode what the strange cold open was about, whether it's a flower in the desert, as in last week, or whether here it's blue and green.
So we get out of the cold open and we're going to therapy with Howard Hamlin. And we're going to get to sit in on a session with Howard Hamlin and his therapist for a little while. Seems like relatively content today. You know, he's just listening to his jazz on his way to his session. Things at work, status quo, humming along. We've got some new big hires. The therapist is like, I'm not a stakeholder, so I don't really care. And Howard says, well, I contend you'd be a hell of a litigator. And then we get some background on Howard Hamlin's home life, there is a Cheryl Hamlin. Is this our first time hearing about Howard Hamlin having a Cheryl Hamlin in his wife?
I really think that it is. I want to give a shout out to Sandy Wilpon, who must have been very prescient because I received a message earlier in the day yesterday asking about whether we had ever heard about Howard having a personal life or any kind of relationships outside of work. And I don't think we have. We talked about it a little bit, and I just don't believe that we have. We've had Howard being introspective about choices that he's made and have looking back on his life and saying, you know, things work out the way they're supposed to. I had wanted to go out on my own. My dad wanted me to come to the firm. Here I am. It was for the best. I envy you, Kim. Like we've seen some personal glimpses behind the Howard Hamlin curtain. But what I don't think we've ever really done is known about his relationships, even if we've seen a glimpse of him in the exterior at his home. And I think we only saw the one car there when Jimmy threw bowling balls on it. We have Cheryl now talked about. Are we talking about Cheryl in therapy, Josh, because we're going to meet Cheryl in an episode or two when things continue to fall apart for Howard Hamlin? I say yes.
Yeah, probably. I think that the other utility of it, and, you know, most times when I say this, I end up being totally wrong, so it's almost like not even worth saying that, like, there are things that are in here clearly because they want to expand upon them. I also think that there could be things in here that are just sort of gestures at the past or gestures at the life outside of the show. And I think that the utility here could be like, these people are about to wreck someone's life. You know, a life that this man is, you know, is trying hard to salvage himself, whether or not he's trying hard to salvage himself. It's a life that he possesses. It's a life that he has. It's a life outside of the bounds of HHM, and it's certainly way outside of the bounds of Wexler and McGill. And it would be enough for me to just know that, like, this is a guy who's already dealing with his shit. He is, like, trying to work through whatever it is he needs to be working through in his life. And this is a man who's just going to have additional things wrecking him pretty soon that are going to make those things that are already deeply fractured fracture even worse. This is like the Santiago of it all, that I don't need to see Santiago. It's enough to know that Gus has this thing in the past, and then in all likelihood we'll see Santiago and we'll meet Cheryl.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily have to be one way or the other that they're saying these things and they matter later. We had in, I think it was in Days of Wine and Roses in episode one, where they pull the con on Howard with the drug bag and Cliff Maine sees it. Cliff Maine has an offhanded remark that he says something like, unfortunately, I'm all too familiar with what one of those looks like. And now we find out in this episode why that stray remark was a stray remark because of Cliff Maine's family. So I think you can always track these stray remarks as things that could come up later. For example, you mentioned new clients, new business, Howard says, we got a new client. They do commercial insurance at some of the biggest providers in Santa Fe. And he mentions that they're a Santa Fe-based client. And I thought, oh, so you pulled a Santa Fe-based client right out from under the noses of Davis & Maine, the law firm Davis & Maine, located in Santa Fe. So now I'm wondering if this great new client is going to get wrecked by this reputational issue that is bubbling up at Davis & Maine regarding Howard Hamlin. Is that a thing? So I think some of these things could be seeds, and some of them are just, like you're saying, explaining that these are full people with full lives and things that are going on, and Jimmy and Kim are wrecking them. So either way, it does work. Speaking of work, we had seen Jimmy dressed like Howard before in season one.
Oh, my God.
Did you expect to see it again? And what is a good name? I've got several alts written down here. What is a good name for Jimmy when he is in when he's in Howard Hamlin mode? Saul Goodlin, is that one?
Nothing that I have is going to do justice to whatever your list is. I would love to hear you just rattle off some of the names. What I'll tell you is the sight of Bob Odenkirk doing his best Patrick Fabian Howard Hamlin impression, or at least this huge caricature of him, because it's so exaggerated.
Yes.
Just the shit-eating grin on his face as he's walking down the alley. I don't know the last time I've shouted out a bigger F you at the television than my first look at him. Like full blast, but I didn't say F dash dash. I said the full word. Like, I didn't say oh fudge. Like, I full out just screamed it. Like, F you, come on, you jerk. He's in therapy right now.
Yes, exactly.
I was so annoyed, but I also loved it, obviously.
Do you know, Josh, every time you go into a therapy session, I dress up as you and gallivant around.
Yes. Again, to pull the curtain back, I hopped off therapy like 5 minutes before this podcast, so I'm feeling great. I had a dream last night that I had to talk about.
That's really
all
funny.
The signs were in a language that I couldn't read.
Saul Goodlin, Saul Hamman, I don't know, Howard Goodham. I don't really have good ones. I'm sure there's a good one out there, but this might be one of my favorite. If you're talking about the Jimmy McGill action figure, this is the limited edition Howard Goodham, and I really think it's hilarious and
gross. Totally, it's
also
gross.
It's also really funny how he's kind of modulating his voice a little bit. Like, even when he's talking to Wendy, he's in character a little bit, and he gets increasingly annoyed she won't get in the car. So I'm loving this. It is gross, and the spray tan is disgusting, but very funny. Spray tan and Satan, by the way, not too far apart.
We're taking shots at Satan.
I'm more like I'm taking shots at spray tans, but
yeah, fair enough. Jimmy's gonna take the car. We've got the answer to the key that had been mapped. Press forward to unlock, six to lock. He's able to hijack the car. He thinks that just putting a cone on a rare misstep for the Wexler McGill operation. This is what Huell is for. No,
good point.
You have Huell show up, occupy the parking spot, and then leave when you come back. You can't pin your hopes on a cone, Antonio.
This is the Chicago and Cicero and Jimmy McGill coming out, because anybody who's ever spent a winter in Chicago knows you got to dig those spots out and you got to claim them. And claiming the spot is tantamount to not just squatter's rights. I mean, that's basically like having a deed. And this is a mortal sin, moving away what someone has cleared out and claimed as their own. So I think Jimmy thinks the cone will be enough, because in Chicago it might have been, and Cicero it might have been. In Albuquerque, they don't play by those rules, especially not at a therapist's office. Like, they needed that spot, man. That was patient parking only. So it was a little dark move by Jimmy. Yeah. And not expected that. They should have known. They should have involved Huell in this. Maybe Huell was busy on this the 18th.
It's possible. Jimmy, though, just saying, they moved the cone? What kind of asshole moves a cone? Says the asshole dressed up as Howard Hamlin.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
What kind of asshole wears a spray tan?
Yeah.
gets the button down, Hamlindigo blue, feathers their hair in such a way. What kind of a-hole does that?
Unbelievable. We get that shot that you and I both like so much of the cameras on the door. So the door is swinging open as you see Jimmy in the background moving the cone into the spot and then getting into the car. It's done extremely well. Ray Seahorn's depiction of the con. We go to the cafe where Kim is in town. And we're set again, another great directorial choice of just centering on Kim's ponytail as she's trying to like shimmy across the table. She's just trying to get the right spot. pot.
Yeah, the shimmying in the chair unfortunately reminded me of Chuck McGill's last acts, and the little rhythmic pounding and shaking and trying to move a chair or move something around, the kicking that Chuck was doing with the lantern. It was very reminiscent to me the way that this was presented, with the jolting, the shaking, and seeing it from a certain angle, not knowing specifically what she was doing at first. It was very reminiscent of that to me. I'm not sure if that was intentional, but it was a reverie for me. We had that email, was it from Spencer Y in the feedback show last week, about the reveries to Breaking Bad. And of course, there are reveries to the show itself, to Better Call Saul. And for me, this stood out as one. I'm not sure if it was intentional or not.
Yeah, I hadn't clocked that, but it is hard to unsee when you point it out. Also hard to unsee. So Kim is going to position her phone underneath the table. Cliff Mayne is showing up. Lots of Cliff Mayne this season of Better Call Saul so far. Not complaining about this. But the thing that's hard to unsee is they are sitting outside a cafe next to a restaurant that appears to be called Limonata, which was also the name of an episode of Barry on HBO that aired this past week, here in an episode where many people are accusing this episode of Better Call Saul as featuring NoHo Hank.
Yes.
So the Saul Barry loop is in full effect.
Yeah, that was the North Albuquerque Hank, the No Ab Hank, not the No Ab Hank.
I don't think that it's. I believe Anthony Carrigan is the actor, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it's the same guy. But I did this morning start to Google NoHo Hank, Better Call Saul, and it autofilled.
Yeah.
So a lot of people had the same question. Doesn't appear to be the same guy.
No Ab Hank. That's who it is.
No. No Ab Hank. So No Ab Hank is a different Hank in the Albuquerque universe.
The minerals, Marie.
Is this town big enough for two Hanks? I'm not so sure. So then Jimmy goes and picks up Wendy, formerly of Breaking Bad, who this is her Better Call Saul debut,
yes.
I believe.
Yes, it is.
And were you excited to see Wendy here showing up on Better Call Saul?
Everyone knows it's Wendy. It was nice to see it. With her and Spooge later, Mr. Spooge, sorry, or Spooge.
It's just
later.
Spooge.
It's just Spooge, not Mr. Spooge.
Just is short for Justin, by the way.
With those two in this episode, they were always, Wendy and Spooge were two characters who actually really showed the practical effects of the drug dealing that Walter White was up to. And in a way, they were kind of standout characters for that reason, because much of the show did not focus on the negative effects to society at large of what Walter White was up to, resting that on Wendy and Spooge in the way that we do during Breaking Bad was a real significant way of showing the real effects, the practical effects of what Walter and Jesse were up to. So I think they were really, really, really important, if small, characters in Breaking Bad. So it was a little heartbreaking, even if it was thrilling, to see Wendy here, because her teeth looked really good. She clearly was not further down the way we saw Spooge later. He didn't have huge sores on his face. He didn't look like he'd been sleeping on the street. So seeing them in the before is shocking in a way, because we know where they end up in Breaking Bad, and it is terrible and horrible. Not that Wendy's life here is great, any great shakes. I mean, she seems to be pretty much on the low end of things. But not where she is in Breaking Bad. Not as bad.
I loved her, like, in the car with Jimmy while he's waiting to get the signal from Kim.
Great performance.
I just really like your hair.
Great performance. Just so good. So good. The actress, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, Julia Mineschi, as Wendy. Fun fact, Josh, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was perhaps a trolling, if not actually popular fan theory, that Kim becomes Wendy, and that's
I
why
had
we don't
heard
see Kim in Breaking Bad.
Yes.
So it was really fun to see those goofballs who really wanted to. I don't even know if anyone took that super seriously, but to the extent anyone did, to kill it dead was really good.
or, and just hear me out,
no.
Clones.
I'm glad I said no before you said clones, because I knew I didn't want it.
Yeah. So I was very happy to see Wendy here as well, and I think a great use of the character.
Her love for root beer is known from Breaking Bad, a constant Indeed. Repeat, the blood sugar. So having it be a through line here with her in that machine is really good.
This was upsetting. Kim is at the cafe with yes. Cliff and talking God. About all of the things that she is trying to do. He's very impressed with what she's talking about. He says, like, but the first thing that I would normally tell you is, like, we have a department for this, but it really sounds like you're putting your money where your mouth is. So I would like to support you in your efforts. And you certainly know about my son, Greg, who has a drug problem. She says, I do. And so that makes it pretty clear then that a big piece of this, of what's going on with this Howard Hamlin con job, is turning a very specific key with Clifford Maine, who is being vulnerable in this moment about how he has a son who has a drug problem, and they are currently setting up Howard Hamlin to appear to have a drug problem so that Clifford Maine will want to, settle the sandpiper thing, get out of this as quickly as possible, and no longer have Howard Hamlin's hair in his hair. So this is really manipulative and gross.
Yeah, particularly triggering for me. Anyone who's ever had a friend or a family member or someone close to them who has struggled with addiction understands the kind of PTSD, literally, yep. that you can acquire from living in that world, and the triggers that can really start to set you off. And so he is specifically being targeted because Kim and Jimmy know this about him. That is unquestionable in my mind at this point, that they know that the play will work on him because it will take advantage of his weakness and his PTSD and his emotional and personal issues with drug addiction and with people who struggle with drug addiction. The thing is, of course, the Howard stuff is going to feel that much more like a lie to him, because it's one of those things where it's like, how could I not see this? I wanted to tell myself it wasn't true. This is the same cycles of behavior all over again. It's going to really work on Cliff Maine. We see it really work on Cliff Maine in the Maine here in his face, but it's going to work on him in general. And he was specifically selected for this, which means that they're putting him through something just to hurt Howard for their legal practice. And I think the other key takeaway, the most important takeaway from this scene, Josh, wasn't that he had been hand selected and that they didn't care about his emotions. It was that they can do this without the sandpiper money. Kim is respected, and she, with an elevator pitch that she didn't even mean to Cliff Maine,
yeah.
got him on board with her idea for the practice. Wait yep. till I get going. So if that could be the thing, if that could work, they don't even ever stop down and acknowledge that. It's not even spoken about, but it is there that totally. They can execute this play without any of this con shit. They can do it on the level because people like Cliff Maine respect the idea and respect Kim. It can be done.
They should have moved the con, Antonio.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's not great. It's not great. I think that's a really astute observation as well. That Kim sells Clifford Maine very, very effectively. But also very effective is Jimmy McGill blasting the Namaste car into the middle of town and kicking Wendy out in full view of Clifford Maine. And Clifford Maine saying, Howard? And Kim saying, I don't know. Happened pretty fast. But the hooks are in. The hooks are very much in.
She can barely contain the glee on her face
yes. as
she sees him being upset. And not for nothing, they clearly knew that he would be in town, and that's why he would be available for this lunch date. That's why it had to happen on the 18th, because yep. he was going to be in town at the same time Howard was going to be in therapy. That says to me that either they've got a mole or somebody that they're working for Cliff Maine's schedule inside Davis and Maine. Or he said he was meeting with Rich Schweikert, so there could be some Schweikert scheduling that they've got some information about there. Either way, they knew that Cliff Maine was going to be in town on this date, and they knew it was going to be a time when Howard was in therapy. So this is a big time. Like there's a lot of spinning plates in the air, and there's a lot of moving parts that they are on top of, whether via post-it note or otherwise.
Yeah, notable, I think, that while Kim is having that conversation with Cliff, she almost forgets to text Jimmy. And there is that moment there where she could call this off. You know, and
gonna move the con.
Yeah, and instead realize that, oh, this is good. I think that I could probably just do this without the sandpiper money, to your point. But no, when she kind of like remembers that this is happening, she just totally goes through with it. So I think that that's a really good observation. Jimmy kicks Wendy out of the car. It's a big to-do. Jimmy goes back to the therapist parking lot. They moved the cone! And that's going to get him into the whole big aggressive removing the sign from the earth and plunging it in like Conan plunges a great sword into his enemies. It was very, very evocative as he is trying to come up with a solution. And Howard, feeling that therapy high, Antonio, doesn't think twice about the fact that his car has moved a whole ass parking spot over to the right. Not even literally a parking spot. This is a no parking zone. He just gets into his car, drives away, none the wiser.
Doesn't see the yellow on the ground. Doesn't see the play that is going on around him. And is just a second short to see the signs falling down. Literally, the signs for Howard Hamlin are there. And if he would only stop to look for them, he would see them falling down around him.
Yep, yep. So Kim is then going to give Wendy a ride back to the motel. Wendy is the one who spots, oh, look, 5-0, always hassling me, those undercovers.
Yeah, and that causes Kim to give Wendy something else besides a ride. She gives Wendy her card, which is an evidence linking Kim to Wendy, which is probably not the best idea. Not for nothing, Wendy also gets boosted in Breaking Bad in season 3 when Jesse Pinkman hires her to be an alibi for him when he's missing on some drug-related stuff. And when I think that's in season 2 when he does this, actually. And in season 2, when this happens, she's brought in for interrogation. No Kim. No Kim. Call to Kim, even though she had the card. Maybe she lost the card over the years, or maybe something else happened.
Kim. So Kim is then going to leave after giving the business card. And the paranoia ramps up as she realizes the same car that Wendy pointed out is now following Kim.
Yep. Kim gets the drop on these followers.
Yes. So we will be exploring that in greater detail in this episode and on the other side of this quick commercial break. Stay tuned. All right, Antonio, we are back. And Kim and Jimmy are home and gleefully recapping in the same way that we recap an episode of Better Call Saul.
Yeah,
they're just gleefully recapping their own hijinks. Yes, of course.
Okay,
of course.
Good, because I'm already in my shorts laying on the bed as I podcast.
And I have been practicing all night long how to say, you're wicked hot.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Jimmy cannot. That's the interesting part of this scene, of course. That in the fact that Kim is calling Cliff's reaction beautiful. Like, that is some serial killer stuff. That is some real Black Widow, spider in the web kind of stuff. And neither of them, she notes that, hey, and also I wasn't even really meaning to do it, but I was stalling for time, and Cliff really liked the idea. He bought in. And neither of them at that point say, okay, then we can call it off. We can stop this. We're good. We got the practice set up. We're going to follow this Cliff Main lead. We don't have to destroy anyone's life. We don't have to get caught. Let's just follow the Cliff Main thing. Let's do this above board. They never say it.
No.
What they do say, though, Jimmy says, we're not being followed. I assure you. He's sure of it, Josh. He's so sure of it.
Yeah. Jimmy, he's got blinders on oftentimes in moments like these. There's a reason why he's gotten into as much trouble as he's gotten into. His offense is pretty strong. I think his defense could use some work. Yeah. And there is a reason why Mike is going to come to Kim as opposed to Jimmy. Because I think he figures, like, she could probably keep a secret. I don't know about Jimmy. I hope so. I would like that to be the case, but I'm not so sure.
Well, and he drops that quote you mentioned from Proverbs. I think it's 28:1. It looks like the wicked flee when no man pursueth, or some iteration or translation thereof. Meaning, I think that, you know, the guilty people are feeling guilty even if no one's around them, and you're feeling guilty because you know we're getting away with it, so you feel like we should be being followed, but in reality, we're just getting away with it. So we only would need to run if no one's around, if we're truly wicked. And Kim says something like, "You think we're wicked?" And Jimmy's like, "Ah, no, it's just a quote, but
wicked hot.
It's definitely, yeah." All he can do is spin it into some dumb joke, because maybe he did mean it subconsciously, or maybe he didn't even think about the fact that it had a subconscious meaning. But clearly, yes, he knows that they both know that they're up to something no good. They both know it.
Yeah, something stupid for sure. Yeah,
something stupid, something unforgivable.
Yes. Okay, so let's go to the courthouse where nobody wants anything to do with Jimmy McGill.
Right.
Everybody, nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. Better go eat lunch alone while fielding calls on my Bluetooth all day. I believe is how that one goes. But Steve-O, the security guard, doesn't like Jimmy. Hannah Banana wants nothing to do with Jimmy. No Beanie Babies are going to get Jimmy any deeper into the system as they once were able to. Even Bill Oakley.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Bill Oakley with some righteous indignation that he gets to display towards Jimmy about, I understand what it's like to advocate for your client. I get it. But when you're scamming the judge, you're scamming the court just to get a murdering psychopath back on the street is where you lose me, is effectively what he says. And Jimmy says, prove it. You can't prove anything. And Bill with a great line of, there's proving and then there's knowing.
Right. Taking the comedic relief, taking the clown, taking the guy who we laugh at and we've come to really enjoy, and turning him into the guy that sticks the knife in such a specific way. Very effective writing.
Listen, chips can be very sharp when wielded properly, Antonio. So double fisting that chip lunch is only a matter of time before the chip turned.
I did the chip turn. I did like that he got his comic moment there, that he got his sad sack Bill Oakley moment, that even though he's the guy who the snack machine won't deliver for and who's so feckless that he can't get them out, and that Jimmy's got an edge on him when it comes to that, he has an edge on Jimmy when it comes to morals, even though he's a prosecutor. And that... that says something. I think that says something, that you've got this guy who, just like Jimmy, is kind of seen as maybe a bottom feeder, or is seen as a guy who will literally eat a lunch that's handed to him. He's still the guy that has that moral high ground over Jimmy in this moment. And for good reason, and Jimmy knows for good reason. Jimmy knows for good reason. And the thing is that this might have laid Jimmy pretty low, because he is the persona non grata at the courthouse, but he's king
Mrs.
of the low
Landry.
Yes.
He's Mrs. Landry right now.
He's Mrs.
Now.
Landry at the courthouse. He's Mrs. Landry in the sheets, but he saw Goodman
Dirty
in the streets.
Landry.
He saw Goodman in the streets, and it doesn't matter that no one at the courthouse likes him, because the people that are paying him the money, they seem to like him an awful lot now that he's Saul Goodman, friend of the cartel.
Yes, he's getting off the clock, just tons of calls, tons of business. He enters the courthouse securing a 3 o'clock, and then by the time it's lunch, he is blowing past 3:30. It's just it's happening for Jimmy. Is people want to know, people want to get in with Salamanca's guy, Antonio.
Yep.
So while he is losing favor here amongst his old peers, he is developing out something that is going to be crucial for him moving forward through the next several years of his life, taking us to Breaking Bad's version of Jimmy McGill. So we
amongst
are
his new peers, right?
Yeah, we are very much in. We're building that railroad, right? We're building that track, and we're getting there. This is stuff that is, you know, it's going to be successful for Saul Goodman at what great cost?
Yeah.
We are seeing the things happening here that we know won't be undone until the other side of Breaking Bad.
Right. They won't be temporary, like the suggested mooted office, which he says it'll just be temporary. He's casting his lot in a direction that will become permanent for him, that we saw the end of at the beginning of this season, at the Days of Wine and Roses, when his house is being taken apart piece by piece. But we're seeing the genesis of it all here. And really, like you said, we're in railroad building territory now. We were settling before. We were getting into a new area. We were stretching out. The train literally brought us to the end of the line with Mike in 5-0 in Albuquerque, and we ended up here. But now we're building out the tracks to get us to Saul Goodman. We've got an office. We've got a name. We've got a clientele. We've got a law practice. He is basically, and for all intents and purposes, other than the personality, pretty much right in that Saul Goodman zone.
Yeah, he even loses the nail salon in this episode.
Yeah, RIP to Mrs. Nguyen, kicks him out.
Well, she's alive, mercifully. Yeah.
We don't know. I mean,
I suppose we don't know. I choose to believe.
I want to believe.
But we do get, just to close the loop on Jimmy's side of things, we will go to the nail salon. There's just a small army of prospective clients here waiting to visit Jimmy in his satellite office today, including Mr. Spooge. Nope, that's just Spooge. Who is looking much more put together than he will be in Breaking Bad. Also, his head just generally is looking more whole.
Yes. Yeah, no giant like
ATM divots
out of his face, right?
Uh-huh.
No ATM sized hole on his head.
That's
right.
Nice.
Yeah, we did see the ATM machine, I believe, in the scenes with Wendy there, but we did not see it falling on any spooges.
Yes.
So yeah, that's not bad. Not a bad deal for him to be whole and made whole here. Not a bad deal at all. It is very interesting, of course, to see. I got to say, before we move to Kim's situation and the juxtaposition of Kim and Jimmy's practices, I did laugh a ton at every time Jimmy said, "Oh yeah, it's just in the back. I'm letting a nail salon use the lobby."
Yeah,
like that's a temporary nail salon, but a permanent back.
It's a pop up. It's a
pop up nail salon. Yeah, I'm letting a nail salon use the lobby. So Jimmy's using a nail salon. Kim, the contrast is pretty clear. Still using the El Camino Diner as her office. That's where she's meeting her clients seemingly all day long. Very clear differences between the two, and the way the scenes jump from one to the other makes that even more clear.
Yes. So with Kim, she is spotting the car again. She sees it.
Yep.
She makes them, and she rolls right up to him, brazen. Kim Wexler can't accuse her of anything else. And she boldly goes to the car. How's your day going? Hey, are you following me? And they just give her the good old nice day. Have a nice day, ma'am, and drive off. And is that NoHo Hank? Is that no ab Hank in the front seat? No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either, unfortunately.
Would be
but
great.
It is no ab Hank. It's not no ho Hank.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll have to see the abs to know for sure. Maybe we'll
Kim Wexler's super great lawyer. So they're gonna drive away, and Kim's gonna go back to work. And when she is going to close out the bill and settle her business for the day, she is still going to be, you know, very visibly twitchy and agitated and nervous and paranoid, and with some good reason. Because even though the car is gone, there is somebody watching her. And what we end up getting is the very first scene between Kim Wexler and the Mantrout. Mantrout, don't want you drinking too much limonada. As he is here, Mike is here at the counter. In my notes, I say I have looking like an absolute daddy in that shirt. He looks great. What do you want me to say? You know, he's like very casual office day for Mike Ehrmantraut. Looks good on him. He's got like the blue plaid button down. Great look. Top button down. Mike Ehrmantraut. Get it.
Turning looks and stunning pretty.
You know, and he tells her everything. He says, I will answer anything that I can. Those are my guys. We're the ones who were following you. And in all of our conversations about who is following Kim and Jimmy, did we have Mike on the list?
We talked about how it kind of looked like Mike's car, but I think that's as far as we went with it.
Yeah. Yep. Are you satisfied with this answer?
Definitely. It makes logical sense that the first thing that the Gus Fring operation would do once they had some sense that Lalo Salamanca lives is put a tail on anybody that Lalo Salamanca might contact. I have to go back and watch everything that happened in the first two episodes again to see where the Jimmy and Kim with the Kettlemans, when we first see someone following them, happens in terms of the comparison to when Gus Fring says Lalo Salamanca lives. Like when that happens, because it would be pretty quick to get this operation up right away on all the people he might contact and put it all right into play if it was just like happening and presented in such a way that it was happening simultaneously. But it certainly tracks logically that this would be the behavior of Gus Fring, that he would batten down the hatches, go to the mattresses, as it were, literally going to the mattresses with a temporary bedroom on the bottom floor of this house. And on and on. So it makes sense that this is what Gus would do in terms of his response. It also makes sense that that sort of scattered, quick response would lead to what it leads to, which is sloppy guys being involved. Mike is still building out his team of guys, doesn't have his most trusted guys that he's sure he can count on.
He's got a ton of guys, but, you know, are they like the best of the best? Yeah.
How many of them can actually
look at Roy, right? You know, who's not Poyos material.
This is what I was going to say. How many of them can actually work at Poyos, even if they're 2 years of McDonald's in college? So damn funny that Gus is like, he's not Poyos material. He's not up to Poyos standards.
Because Gus actually does care about it, whether it's just because he like cares about the sanctity of the cover of Poyos Hermanos, or if at this point he also has come to really love Poyos Hermanos.
Yeah, yeah. This is a guy who in every aspect of his life, let's not forget, I believe that the Poyos Hermanos in general comes
it's
from
the
Max
side of things. Yes, absolutely. It comes from Max. So it needs to be immaculate because this is in a large part in tribute to the man he
lost.
This
is Max's legacy, right?
Yep.
So it makes sense to me on that level for sure.
Yeah. But I really loved this meeting with Mike and Kim, and Mike ultimately, when she's saying, why are you talking to me about this and not him, and him saying, I think you're made of sterner stuff, which tracks. Which is also a real kind of scathing indictment of Jimmy in the Desert, even at the very end of Jimmy in the Desert and Bagman, that he still thinks that Kim Wexler is, the one made of sterner stuff. He's like, well, maybe Jimmy is made of sterner stuff than I thought he was, but you're sterner. You wouldn't have complained the whole way until that very final scene.
Right. And I think hearing, you know, Mike is knowing that, of course, just to refresh, based on the fact that he was on the other side of a phone call where Kim stood up to Lalo. Mike does not know what Kim maybe said to her in the police station. He doesn't know how that went down in the jail. But he does know how it went down when Lalo came into their apartment,
right?
How she stood up to him. And that's where Mike is forming this impression from.
This is her first meeting with Mike. This is not Mike's first meeting with Kim.
Right.
Though it's not entirely Kim's first meeting with
not
Mike.
Not entirely.
As she says, wait, you're the attendant.
Yeah.
You were in the toll booth.
Yeah.
And he says, I was.
I was another life ago. I was.
Maybe somewhat wistfully. I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of felt that way where it's like, I should have stayed in the toll
booth. I was the attendant and you were the high, the big firm, the big law lawyer. And look where we both are now. You're meeting your clients in this same diner and I'm not the attendant anymore. And we're both wrapped up in Lalo Salamanca.
Yeah,
so it's sort of like,
here we are in the El Camino diner and potentially neither of us will be around for El Camino proper.
Indeed. And we both lived these previous lives. Yes, I was in the toll booth. And yes, you were a different kind of person as well. So this was the scene of the episode for me.
I loved it.
I always like when characters who are major characters on these shows have never had a scene together and we finally get the scene with them together. It'd be incredible to see Gus meet Kim, for example, because we know that Jimmy didn't really know who Gus was. And we had the meeting with Jimmy and Gus when Jimmy was staking out Poyos, looking for his watch in the trash can. That was a great scene that sizzled because here these two longtime characters finally get to meet. It would be incredible to see this go to the next level and to see Kim find out the question that Mike couldn't answer when Kim asks, who are you working for? So that would be something, and it could be something that we do see at some point, and I would love it if we did.
Oh, Kim is Gus Spring's lawyer?
Could be.
Interesting.
We've talked a lot about who was the first vacuum cleaner person. How does Jimmy find out about it? Is that going to be a thing we see? Where is Kim heading? Is she heading toward being a friend of the cartel? I mean, not for nothing, but Kim's priorities about how we could screw up this one person's life, this relativism that she's applying to her ethics and her morality, it's probably exactly the way that Gus Fring operates. When Mr. Acker read Kim for Filth and said, you're one of those rich people who just throw a bunch of money at charity every month and feel like you're doing the right thing.
Right.
That is what Gus Fring maybe does to an extent. Now, for Gus, in some ways, it's cover. It's cover to be giving so much money to the police and all these auxiliary funds, but setting up clinics in the desert and paying for all these things, paying for schools for kids. Those are the things that Gus is doing quietly. And those are the same things that would certainly speak to Kim, right? It's like, yes, on one hand, we're going to do something bad, But with the other hand, we're going to do something great. And you have to be the scales yourself and balance those hands out. And I think Kim could really see that aspect of Gus Fring and see it as, I just see it as the next logical step from what Kim is doing right now, which is she's willing to do all these untoward, ruinous things for one person to benefit multiple people. If you scale that up and say the benefits could be much greater, yes, more people are going to get hurt, but more people will be helped. I could see Kim on that track. So I think it's fascinating to think of those two characters together in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now that we know that it's Gus who's had Mike following Kim, or at least that it's Mike who's been following Kim as he's trying to cover all bases for where is Lalo Salamanca, we do get to walk a mile in Gus's shoes, or however far the distance is between houses via that tunnel. And I love getting to spend this alone time with Gus Fring, Antonio. I think that we've been talking quite a bit over these last few podcasts about a Gus Fring who's off his game, a Gus Fring who is shook, who is nervous, who's breaking glass, and the glass is coming back to break him. And we get to see a lot of those nerves while he's all alone with nobody watching. But we're also still getting to see, like, the tightness with which he wants to control that stuff. I think that there is still just sort of this emotionally taut quality to Gus Fring as he goes home and takes off the banana dress shirt and has the pale white bulletproof vest on over his undershirt. And he's stressing over, what should I wear next? He's stressing over, I'm just going through my safety tunnel. Do I need my ankle holster gun with me? I think I do. I don't know. There is just a level of tension within Giancarlo Esposito's performance as Gus Fring in these scenes that is captured in this episode that I, again, think is just bringing us a lot closer to his headspace. And for me, not just is doing a lot of work in making his story here on Better Call Saul very satisfying, but this is really enriching his Breaking Bad arc as well for me, of a guy who is not just, you know, the fully indestructible supervillain that will come to view him as for so much of Breaking Bad, but a guy who can be shaken and stirred as well.
That I love too. Just like I love these scenes where we see characters who have never met meet for the first time, whether it's Kim and Wendy or whether it's Kim and Mike or the possibility of a Kim and Gus scene. I also love any scene we get to see Gus Fring in private time, especially in his house. Fascinating to see the fastidiousness of Gus Fring in his basement with all the various containers full of God knows what, some kind of clothing, different outfits. His anxiety, as you're pointing out, is also interesting to see because, of course, he doesn't project that publicly. And he's in a position as a kingpin in a world full of machismo and full of the certain ways of being, and a guy who already invites criticism from those people that he works with just by virtue of the things that about him that he can't change, things that he was born with or things that are that mark him as an outsider for them. These things that are just not changeable in his life. Fascinating to see behind the facade a little bit of the Gus Fring. I love that nervous moment. I love him not knowing whether he should keep the gun or not. And his paranoia is real, but we as an audience know it's really it's well placed. Mike, of course, is saying to him, much like Howard was saying to Chuck when Chuck had his whole setup, his sting operation, the private investigator there waiting for Jimmy in his house and how much that was costing. And was this too much? And this, the guy, Jimmy hasn't done anything. Like, and Mike is saying very similar things to Gus here. Like, he hasn't made a peep. He hasn't come up. It was very reminiscent again of these scenes with Howard and Chuck. And we know Gus is right. We know Gus is correct. Mike can say this. Are we sure we really need to go to all these lengths? We know Gus is right about this. And Gus knows Gus is right about it. So even if he's nervous and even if he's not sure, and even if his anxiety is through the roof, he's correct. He's correct about this. He's right about this. Lalo is coming eventually. Lalo lives. We know that. Even if Gus is basing that on something that is just a cold read of what's on Hector's face or whatever it is, we know it to be true as an audience. So we know that Mike is saying these things, and I know you're paranoid about that green van that followed you for three blocks. He was just a plumber. You don't have to go so overboard. We know that he has to go so overboard. And I believe that all these snares will eventually trap Lalo Salamanca. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, 2 weeks and we haven't had a tickle.
Yep.
And Lalo is alive, but if he is alive, then where is he?
That's a good question for Mike. It's a good question for us, right?
Yes. And, you know, it takes us nicely into the final scene of the episode. And then again, just to quickly say, I just love Gus being so upset about this fry cook, Roy.
Oh, yeah, just so funny.
It's just so funny. It's just
up to Pollo's standards.
It's just a great moment of levity, but also just a great character note of, as we mentioned, Gus's care for Pollo's and the reasons why he would care, but also I think Gus's ability to multitask. He could carry the anxiety in the same emotional moment that he can carry his concern for the new fry cook that has been employed. So we stand a multitasking king. But I love this question of, if Lalo is alive, then where is he? That takes us into this final scene of the episode where, I don't know about how you were watching it, Antonio, but I'm spending much of this final scene being like very paranoid as well about, is Lalo going to pop up behind Jimmy and Kim right now? Instead, we end up escaping this entire episode without a Lalo Salamanca sighting. But what we are glimpsing right now is a no less significant, and indeed a tremendously significant, advancement in the Saul Goodman evolution and the de-evolution of Jimmy McGill, as here we are at this this cathedral of justice in the making, Antonio.
Indeed, indeed. A diamond in the rough, a real diamond in the rough. Temporary office, just don't move the toilet.
It's dirty, it's small, it smells funny, but the parking is good, it's close to the courthouse, and Taco Cabeza, it's just around the corner.
Yeah, we need a shout out from our Albuquerque correspondent to tell us if Taco Cabeza is legit and a real joint that is worth visiting.
Yeah. So Kim ultimately is going to give it the thumbs up. And there are a lot of moments in this scene where I'm waiting for Kim to break and say something about Lalo. And she never does. She, you know, closes out the episode looking over her shoulder. And that's a very pointed note that she's looking out for something that Jimmy has no awareness over. And I think that this idea of the various ways in which Jimmy and Kim are alternately taking turns as secret keepers on this show is fascinating to me. I wondered if you had any thoughts about the fact that Kim doesn't say any of this. She doesn't mention any of this. She just lets Jimmy be excited about the day that he's had, and she just signs off the check mark. She, in the same way that Gus is able to multitask, maybe is doing the same thing here.
The back and forth between the two of them with these details about what happened in the desert and Lalo Salamanca and all of that is fascinating, because we talked about it a little bit on the feedback show last week. Who knew what, when, Jimmy going to Mike and interrogating him at the end of last season, and Mike saying, before the end of the night, it'll be done. He'll be dead. And so Jimmy knows that this is the case. What he tells Kim, of course, is not, I know Lalo Salamanca is going to get murdered tonight. It's just, I talked to my guy. He's not going to call anybody. He's going to stay in Mexico. Kim can read between the lines on that, of course, to know that this is something that involved gunfire. Jimmy was shot at, $7 million. This guy's a murderer. This guy's a cartel guy. So probably what Jimmy is saying to me here is he's going to be killed, and I have to be okay with that. Then when it actually is stated aloud, Jimmy has to pretend shock and feign this unawareness. So there is a very complicated and I don't think fun game that the two of them are playing, keeping details about the unspeakable from each other, that they don't want to acknowledge this shark in the room. It's not an elephant in the room, right? It's a shark in the water. And both of them have had at times private information that they don't want to share with the other about it, because they're keeping the other from it emotionally. This is a big one, though, for sure. And who knows how it will affect their relationship, what impacts it will have in decision-making for Kim going forward. Mike, I think, is correct, of course, that Kim is made of sterner stuff. But what Mike can't necessarily know is everything else that's going on with Kim, the depth of what the stuff is made of, the depth of what the stuff is that may resonate in knowing that Lalo is around out there. He doesn't necessarily know how Kim will react with everything, the complex alchemy that is Kim Wexler. Mike can't possibly understand that. So I'm fascinated to see Kim being the secret keeper. What will this lead to?
That just reminds me, we didn't talk about this much, but in that scene with Mike and Kim of him being like, I know you're into some stuff that you'd rather people not find out. Like, what does he make of everything that's going?
Yeah.
What are they? He's buying a full case of root beer. Yeah. You know,
I want to know. I want to know what this looks like from Mantrout's point of view.
Yeah. How was he dressed? What was he wearing? He did look. His hair was what? Why was it? Yeah. The whole thing. Mantrout. Yeah. It's going to be all over.
Mike having eyes on Jimmy in fake Howard mode. Like, it's such a bummer that we don't get that reaction.
Just see Mike rolling his eyes and shaking his head.
Yeah. This is why he knows that she's made of sterner stuff.
Yes. She would never dress like Howard Hamlin.
Yeah, here he is doing Howard Hamlin cosplay.
You know, it's just unbelievable. I think that this is another reason why, though, that the Lalo Salamanca of it all is clearly going to be critical to what's happening on the Fring side of the storyline. And we don't know the ways in which it's going to impact Jimmy and Kim, if it's going to be a literal return for Lalo in their lives. If not, just the existence of Lalo as a boogeyman that is catalyzing a growing divide in the, you know, in the relationship between Jimmy and Kim, that's eroding the trust between the two of them even further. That is enough, you know, to advance that storyline. And that storyline, I think, is meaningfully advanced in this episode. We're not just seeing the stress levels on Gus Fring that are being accelerated by the unknown qualities of Lalo Salamanca, but we are also seeing the effects of Lalo Salamanca on the lives of Jimmy and Kim as well, both in terms of Jimmy's booming business because he's associated with the Salamanca name now, but also in terms of how Kim may be taking all of this and how she'll continue to take all of this is a really good question, but also what will her withholding of this information do to her relationship with Jimmy is another thing that is very much an X factor at this point in time. So this is a really character-rooted episode that I think would mask the fact that I think that this is also a really important episode for where we're moving forward. This is a classic sort of chess pieces episode, Antonio. On the other side of some of these great Hallmark episodes of television, you often get an episode that kind of feels like a clunker in relation to it. There's a terrible Juliet episode that follows The Constant on Lost. We talked about how the episodes on the other side of Chicanery, for example, are a little bit challenging, perhaps, to recapture that same climactic energy from that episode. I don't feel that with this one. I think that that's in no small part thanks to a real specificity in the way that this episode feels as it's directed, as it's presented to us. But I also do think, even just beyond that, I think some really important emotional stuff transpires over the course of Hit and Run. I was impressed by this one. Maybe not as much on the first blush, but the rewatch of this episode for me was extremely rewarding.
Yeah, and I've had a few people reach out and point out some of the, not just the camera stuff, the flourishes that we talked about, but the blocking or the way that certain scenes were just the way that certain the way the camera moved around, but also the way the camera in stationary revealed certain things. There is the bedroom scene where Kim and Jimmy are talking about how Cliff Mayne reacted. And it's shot in semi-darkness. There's a light on. Of course, the light is on Jimmy's side of where he's sitting in the frame. And the shades are open much wider on Jimmy's side. Little details like that. Several people did reach out to me and pointed that out. And there are little details like that throughout the episode. I'm thinking of the camera floating over the lunch area outside of the courthouse where we're looking down on Jimmy. And looking down on him from our perspective, the camera being alive and being part of this made us feel, I think, more present in this episode and had us looking down on the characters, had us remarking on the characters, had us seeing the differences in the light for them. And just a really, really well executed job by Ray Seahorn. Just something very impressive about this. being her first directorial effort and everything that was put here. You're right. I think it escapes the curse of being the resolution or the falling action or whatever you want to call it, the refractory, the recovery period after such an intense episode. I think it escapes that in part because we're moving the con a lot further forward, something that's been talked about for a little while here. This is the 18th, the day it had to happen, because this was the day Cliff Mayne was in town, and this was the day Howard would be in therapy at the same time. So we're seeing these things that they've talked about. We're seeing it play out. No remark on Nacho. The papa part, I think, could still be dealt with in a later mm-hmm. episode. We haven't gotten there yet, especially if Lalo's going to play a part in that. Do you want to put any theories forward before we end here about where Lalo might be?
Oh, gosh. Knowing Lalo, he's probably like hiding in a sub-basement within the sub-basement of Gus's safe house.
Oh, my gosh.
He's just the boogeyman under the bed at this point. I don't know. I'm not sure. One of the things that I think will be really compelling is if the dude is just on the la low until the Breaking Bad or even the Gene timeline. I have no really good guesses at this moment in time. I'm sure if I spend some time thinking about it in the next couple of days before the feedback show, that could change. But I really, Antonio, I love the lack of knowing right now, especially when we're dealing with a prequel show where so much is known. The idea that other things aren't known, that there are still so many questions that we have, and Lalo being a huge one, and where is he and how is he going to change this story, remains highly malleable. That's exciting. That's really, really good.
Yeah, I agree. And it is highly malleable. There are a number of things he could be doing, as we've talked about. I've seen a little talk online that maybe he's in Germany. Like maybe he went all the way to Germany somehow. Are we going to get Lalo on a ship somehow in like steerage and like deep hold, smuggling his way to Germany to try to interview Marguerite Ziegler, or perhaps try to find Kai or somebody else connected to the Super Lab plan to interrogate that aspect of the South Wall and everything that happened with Werner? We know that Lalo knows about this, and he had his nose out of joint about it significantly. So that would be fascinating if where Lalo's been is in the hold of some kind of ship headed to Europe, and he wakes up and he's in Germany kind of tracking that down. Tony Dalton traipsing throughout Germany. I bet I'd love to see some of the accents that he puts on. I think that would be great. Or is it Jack Duquesne, like, yes, sliding in and out of these accents?
Yes,
Tony Dalton's got it. He could slide right into Germany, I have a feeling.
I would be psyched about that. I think that would be tremendously fun. I think wherever he is, I am not frustrated with the nebulousness of it. I am enthralled by it. The longer we go without seeing Lalo, the more intense it's probably going to be when his impact is felt again, when he rears his head. Him showing up in Germany in like a cold open where we're with Kai again, just pounding beer, would be incredible. Absolutely incredible. I would love to see something like that. Let's get some Lalo theories from the listeners, huh?
Yeah, let's
send them in. BCS@postshowrecaps.com. That's BCS@postshowrecaps.com. If you've got any theories about where is Lalo, now I'm just imagining Tony Dalton in a Waldo uniform. Where's Lalo? Is a fun thing to consider. We would love to hear that from you. We would also love to hear any other theories or any other feedback about any aspects of this episode or the final season of Better Call Saul generally, which we will address in our forthcoming feedback show later in the week. Again, send that in, BCS@postshowrecaps.com. Or you can tweet at us. I'm at Round Howard, like Howard Hamlin, but rounder. Antonio is at AC Mazzara with the same amount of Z's and R's as the start of this episode.
Correct. Like Elon Musk, but more honest.
You can talk to both of us in the Post Show Recaps Patreon Discord as well. Patreon.com/postshowrecaps. If you want to sign up, start of the month. We certainly appreciate it. Your support of the podcast means the world to us and makes it possible for podcasts like these to hit your feeds. That's patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Rating and reviews on the podcast as well. Tremendously appreciated. Antonio, anything else? Anything else going on?
looking through my notes, I think that's it. I did finish watching Ozark, Josh. Uh-huh. So at some point, you and I owe a final
Ozark
podcast. Yes.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about how much I owe Zark. It's a lot.
Talk about Ozark.
Yeah. There you go. You got a Bruno in. So, yeah, I have finished Ozark as well. Now Antonio has. And now the tricky thing is finding the time to podcast about it. Yeah. We could do that very soon, or it might take a minute. So it's a wild Ozark podcast will appear in your feed either very soon, or it could take a tiny bit of time. Either way, we are planning on doing it, and we will toss it out here in the Better Call Saul podcast feed. We will give you copious opportunity to turn that podcast off once it starts with a lot of filibuster to make sure that you are not getting spoiled accidentally. And if you are not watching the show and you see it pop up in your feed, just delete that. You don't want to pay attention to it. But a lot of the people who are enjoying Better Call Saul are also enjoying Ozark, and this will be the home for that podcast. So keep an eye out for it. We have thoughts. We will express them in our forthcoming Ozark finale podcast. All right, Antonio, we'll be back in a couple of days with more Hit and Run. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.